homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. When Peggy Kennett went to Malaysia and Japan, she had already been a Buddhist since her mid to late teens. And she was exposed to Buddhism for the first time through her father reading The Light of Asia to her when she was a child. She had been a member of the London Buddhist Society for some period of time, had met various Buddhist teachers and teachers of Zen. She had also, when she was in her teens, was at the London Buddhist Vihara, which was a center of Theravada teaching. And one of her first lessons in Buddhism was when the monks at the London Buddhist Vihara showed her a plastic skeleton and proceeded to take it apart as an illustration of the understanding of the lack of a separate self. In Japan, after the revolution of the late 1860s, there was a great adaptation of Western ideas that permeated the entirety of Japanese society, and a tendency to regard the old ways as redundant. And part of what this became was a massive interest in the works of the philosopher Nietzsche. The monk, who in The Wild White Goose is called Hajime, who is teaching Reverend Master quite a few things and going over the scriptures with her, once said to her that he was afraid that he was useless to her because he had been too much influenced by these ideas. These ideas have very much, as I said, influenced at least certain sections of Japanese Zen, and then passed very much into these influences into particularly Western Zen as well, exemplified by an emphasis on emptiness as a type of nothingness, a tendency to lessen the importance of the teaching of karma and rebirth, and the teaching of precepts. So when Reverend Master arrived back in the West, in the United States, in California at that particular time, she ran into directly these influences upon Zen as it was being taught. This resulted in her being considered in many quarters to be eccentric, even though what she was teaching was actually quite conventional Zen. This tendency to regard her as an eccentric outside the mainstream only recently ceased, due partly to the massive influence in Western Buddhism of the Theravada and of Tibetan Buddhism, the teachers of whom found nothing eccentric at all in regards to what Reverend Master taught. The Buddha in India was known preeminently as the teacher of causation and the teacher of how cause and effect work. Indeed, one of the most ancient summaries of Buddhism that was considered so essential that it was carved on stone was the summary of Buddhism as how cause and effect work, the Buddha taught, and how they come to an end, he also taught. Part of his teaching has to do with how cause and effect continue past the end of what we call life. In Buddhism in general, the distinction that we make in the West between life and death as states is not actually made, and the terms used are more birth and death, meaning two gateways in a continuum, rather than one state ending and another beginning. When Reverend Master first began to teach in more detail about karma and rebirth, she ran into considerable resistance when she began to teach it over here. And that, as I said, was at least partially due to the influences I previously mentioned. And also, it was due to the distinction that people continually make between training and realization. They think that Buddhist training, the purpose of Buddhist training, is to achieve enlightenment. But the purpose of the training, as I described yesterday, have to do with training selfishness. Enlightenment, realization, doesn't come from somewhere else. It is not bestowed by a god. It does not arrive from far away. It is rather the absence of selfishness and the selfish way of looking at things and interacting with people. And the path of Buddhist practice has to do with training, as I said the other day, training the self, training selfishness, and all the teaching of the Dharma is pointing in that direction and is for that purpose. If you can understand that, then you can understand how to go about Buddhist training. Reverend Master used to use the metaphor that the person who first discovered that you could use, first discovered that you could use a rock to strike another rock, discovered the hammer. But the person who discovered the hammer did not set out to make a new tool. They set out, rather, to break the rock to solve their particular problem. I, myself, have always found the instructions of the third Chinese ancestor, Kanchi Sōsan, to be very succinct, so much so that I've thought of calligraphing it and putting it up at the walls of the priory. And this advice is in response to questions regarding the nature of enlightenment, etc., etc. And the third Chinese ancestor wrote, said, "Don't worry about seeking after the ultimate. Only cease to cherish opinions. When people first enter into training in this tradition, one of the most important things that they can learn is the nature of opinions. Many people think that they have strong views on particular topics that they hold to, but in fact, their views are the views that they have picked up from other people, or picked up from stray books, or picked up wherever. You note the third Chinese ancestor says about cherishing opinions. We will always have views about things. It's the nature of the brain that, based upon previous experience, it generates views. And as the Buddha said, if we are always tossed around by the views and opinions that come to us from various sources, that we pick up by the side of the road almost, then we will be trapped in the thicket of views and opinions, and we'll be unable to get out. These instructions are not trying to get people to not have views or to submit their minds or their views to their teachers. It has nothing to do with that. There is an old story in which the advice was about being deceived by opinions and views. When Reverend Master taught regarding karma and rebirth, she was not attempting to teach it in terms of a particular viewpoint, philosophical or otherwise. That one was supposed to accept. But rather, within the context, like with everything else in training, within the context of experience, I was told a long time ago, before I became a monk, before I even knew about Shasta, that you can spend your life sitting at the crossroads, as it were in an armchair, watching things go by, watching various spiritual teachings come and go. But if you're going to get anywhere, you have to get up off your chair and walk down the road. Since the Buddha's teaching cannot be understood outside of practicing it. Given that it is preeminently a practice. The results of understanding karma and rebirth are wisdom, knowing that all beings who enter this life enter with baggage of some sort or the other. And, aside from wisdom, compassion. Because everybody is in this same boat. I've sometimes described it as like in a dream or a nightmare. You get off the Greyhound in some little community or other. You have luggage, but you cannot remember packing it. Neither do you remember where you came from. Birth is like this. Meditation through stillness and practice of the precepts help us to clarify our inner eye, as it were, so that we can see where the baggage came from. This doesn't necessarily require huge revelations. The Buddha said if you want to know about the deep past, you have to look at how you are now. If your problem is being angry and irritable, it means that you have inherited the karma of somebody who developed anger and irritability. It's really not much more complicated than that. to understand the teaching regarding karma and rebirth widens one's horizons and also widens the horizons of the world and the universe. Because we can then see compassion pervading everything. Reverend Master Jiyu said, as I quoted before, that when she went to the East, she thought she was searching for the reason people or the world is as it is, when in fact she should have been looking at how she was the way she was, what she called the first arising of selfishness. Dogen and Tendo both say that an understanding of karma and rebirth is essential to Buddhist practice. One of the things that stands in the way of understanding a lot of the Buddha's teaching is fear. Fear arises in these circumstances due to, if I can put it this way, the fear of the self, of dissolution. What will become of me? What will become of me if I venture down this road of Buddhist training into the unknown? Yet one will never know unless one does so. That is the only way of understanding what the Buddha taught. It cannot be understood aside from practice. Also, the teaching of karma and rebirth, as I said, expands the horizons in terms of time. Reverend Master said that you cannot really judge how far along a person is spiritually, because someone who is lying drunk in the gutter may be further along spiritually than you are. That does not mean, however, that you have to let the drunken person into the gate of the monastery until they cease to be drunk. That is another thing about the expansion of this horizon. You see that everybody is working out, as the Buddha said to do, working out their salvation with diligence. Everybody is, no matter how strange it may seem, doing the very best they can in the circumstances that they find themselves. This is no divine revelation. It is rather that out of the grounds of our mutually experienced suffering arises in the course of time the desire to do something about it. And from the desire to do something about it arises in time the effort to do something about it. The seeking out of teachers and the learning to practice. As the Dhammapada says, what life's course and cause sustain, these the Tathagata made plain. What delivers from life's woe, that the Buddha has made us know. Evil swells the debts to pay, good delivers and acquits. Shun evil, follow good, hold sway over yourself. This is the way. Homage to all the Buddhas in all worlds, homage to all the Bodhisattvas in all worlds, homage to the scripture of great wisdom.